be sitting here in the seat and to be able to speak Dharma, talk about our practice to all of you, and to have so many people come week after week, and for me to sit here week after week and speak, I feel it's a great privilege that people are willing to listen. And also, I feel it's also a great privilege to be able to speak about the Dharma, about Buddhism, or about religious practice. And part of what it means to practice, and I think part of what it means sometimes to speak about the Dharma, speak about the practice, is an exploration. And as many of you know, we emphasize more the process than the goal, or the process rather than content. And I think sometimes when I give these talks, I'm very much in process in what I'm trying to say and what I'm trying to explain. And last Monday, I felt it was a kind of process talk for me. I was kind of exploring something I never talked about before. And this evening, what I'm going to talk about is sexuality. And what I'm interested in trying to talk about, is the relationship between the practice we do here, our mindfulness practice, and our sexuality. And if I stray too much from that linkage, then that's not really what I want to do. That's not really the purpose of this particular format here. And I've been spending the last couple of weeks talking about sexuality in different groups like this. And last night I did a workshop or evening on the subject of Spirit Rock. And one of the things that has become clear is that the subject of sexuality is almost never talked about. Virtually never talked about by Buddhist teachers or by certainly Vipassana teachers. And other kind of senior students that I've known and the other Vipassana teachers that I've known, when I mentioned to them that I was going to be talking about this, they say, "Oh, Jack Kornfield talked about this once." And that was 10 years ago. And he has apparently a tape of that talk, and the tape kind of circulates, but it's 10 years old. Maybe sexuality isn't age, but... and some people have pointed out that there's a subtle message that is made when we never talk about it. And we often talk about many other interesting subjects, about the integration of this practice in daily life. But sexuality is something which we never speak about. And I never really talked about it explicitly in the 4 or 5 years I've been coming here and speaking. And one of the things we're trying to do in mindfulness practice is not only deepening our awareness, deepening our practice, but also bringing our practice in the depth of it into all aspects of our daily life, to integrate, to embrace our ordinary everyday life in the field of awareness practice itself. And over again, one of the areas which we tend not to bring a lot of awareness, mindfulness practice to, I think, is sexuality, because it's charged or difficult. And by never talking about it, never kind of putting it out on the table and bringing it clearly within the scope of mindfulness practice, we're reinforcing whatever tendencies we have of leaving that part of our life outside of the practice, kind of making a division. And whenever we see division in mindfulness practice, that should be a flag. We should pay attention to what's going on, because the attempt in mindfulness practice is to try to make something seamless, try to bring everything together in a kind of in some way or other, not to have too many divisions. So dividing one aspect of our life from another, one area of our life we practice and another we don't, that's a division that should be a big flag. I thought it was important to talk about it and bring it out. And the main agenda I have is simply to put the subject out on the table and say, look, this should be in the arena of our mindfulness practice just like anything else. And now we can go home. practice. We have to go home for that? And I wasn't going to say this, but this story I've told once before here, but it just occurred to me. There's a beautiful story of that Cornfield has told of a couple who was a student of a Japanese Zen master here in America who did koan practice, strong koan practice. And the wife went to the Zen master and complained that her husband was a monk, Zen monk, and complained that he was so serious about practice and he was always engaged in serious meditation practice that he was ignoring the family, ignoring her. And their personal relationship was nothing was really developing and growing there. And it was a big, big source of strain for her. So the Zen master said, both of you come to the next sesshin, the next 7-day retreat. And so they both came. And then at the beginning of the retreat, he called them into the interview room. And he said, at this retreat, I want you both to... your koan for this retreat is to find the Buddha nature, find the Buddha in your partner. So that's pretty good. And then he said, I want you to... usually in a Zen monastery, you're supposed to be very strict about the schedule and always be in the meditation hall. And he said, whenever you feel at all inclined to go and be sexual, you know, probably 2, 3, 4 times a day, you should go back to your room. So this couple, you know, would periodically be noticed that they weren't in the meditation hall. And as the retreat went on, they were glowing more and more and more. More and more radiant as the week went on. And this monk who had kind of separated that part of his life out from the practice maybe discovered that the Buddha nature, that the awakening of practice could be found also in his relationship and his sexual relationship. And perhaps the division that he'd made was healed. So it's an experimental subject. I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on sexuality any more than any other American is who's 40 years old, which maybe is not much, I don't know, average person. And I can't say that I've really practiced intensely with my mindfulness practice in this area. So this is an area which I don't know much about. But I think that's okay because I think very few other people in Buddhism know about this. And to the degree in which we're willing to bring this part of our life into the field of practice, we are, in a very real sense, pioneers. And in part, that's because Buddhism itself has almost nothing to say about ordinary sexuality. When it talks about sexuality at all, it tends to talk about extreme forms of sexuality, or it talks about ethics, sexual ethics. And extreme forms of sexuality is monastic sexuality, which is sexuality of a celibacy. And the whole range of what sexuality means in that context is very interesting. But it's the sexuality of celibacy. And monastics, historically, because of the kind of nature of the community they are, because of the kind of vows, lifelong vows, the vows they have seemed to have had a tendency towards degrading sexuality. Maybe because they're frightened by it, or guilty by it, or it's threatening to them, or who knows why it is. But monastics have often kind of put down sexuality, held it at a distance, and maybe because they don't know about it. And people who don't know about sexuality are often the ones who feel the most uncomfortable with it. And so you find in a lot of Buddhist literature, especially literature coming from the monastics, certainly a lot of the early Buddhist sutras, which was compiled by the monastics, language which tends to look down on sexuality to some degree, to not think very highly of it, to call it kind of, well, this, you know, lay people, it's fine for lay people to do it, but if you're really serious about spiritual practice, it was understood in ancient India that you weren't going to be involved in sexuality, that sexual activity was not compatible with the spiritual path. And the other kind of extreme form of sexuality you find in Buddhist texts and in Buddhist tradition is tantric sexuality, the tantric Buddhism. And tantra is mostly not about sex. I don't know how many of you, but the kind of popular idea is that Tantra means sex. Tantric Buddhism is mostly not about sex, but there is a sexual element to it. And that's it's a huge, very complicated and obscure and difficult subject to unravel what it is, because Buddhist Tantra has many different aspects to it. But most of us, I think, if we discovered what Indian Buddhist Tantra was about and the sexual aspects of it, probably wouldn't be interested. There's a lot of Neo-Tantra being taught in the West nowadays, but there's very little relationship between the Neo-Tantra and Buddhist Tantra, the traditional forms of it. One of the things, for example, there's many forms, but I can give you some examples of why you probably wouldn't be interested in it. But one example is that in more serious disciplined forms of sexual Tantra, you're expected to be a celibate, serious practitioner for about 20 years before you're introduced to the rituals. And are you willing to wait 20 years? Also, a lot of it was didn't involve a partner, but actually involved ritual, visualization. Also in Tantra, there's an emphasis in Tantra where you're not supposed to have an orgasm. So are we still interested? So anyway, whatever it is, Tantra is kind of extreme. And what I mean is not extreme is ordinary, everyday sexuality of lay people, householders. And it was understood by the Buddhist tradition that householders were generally sexual, and it was fine for them to be sexual, but there's no talk about it, no discussion about how that can be practiced or can be included within mindfulness practice. So there's this big void for us. And we as lay people are kind of a strange breed, because some people have called us a hybrid between monastics and lay people, because we're doing very serious practice. We're doing a meditation practice which has traditionally been the domain of monastics. But we're also still insisting on being lay people and having all the issues of being lay people. And so we bring issues of lay life into the scope, into the field of a religious practice that was normally done outside of lay life, outside of sexuality, for example. So in doing that, it's an experiment, perhaps. It's an exploration. And no one really, I don't know, I don't have any clear things to say about it, except putting it on the table and exploring it together. But I have some things to say, so I'll say some more things. One is, I think it's interesting to say a little bit about Buddhist sexual ethics. The simplest thing to say, and which is often said, is that the primary criteria for deciding what is ethical and unethical sexually in the Buddhist context is, does it harm someone? If anybody is harmed at all, whether it's you or your partner or other people associated to those people, if anybody is harmed, then it's considered inappropriate. And that's kind of like the base criteria. Beyond that, some people would say anything goes. And I don't want to exactly say that, but what I want to say is that Buddhism has basically, as it's moved through Asia, assumed a lot of the cultural values of the culture it found itself in. And that is true for sexuality also. And perhaps what harms people is partially culturally conditioned. It's kind of what the culture kind of defines as being appropriate and inappropriate, and the kind of has to do with culture. And what the culture teaches us we are, and what we are in relationship to others. And that varies from culture to culture. And Buddhism has been quite malleable, quite willing to go along with different cultural definitions. So, for example, in the field of marriage, some cultures that Buddhism went to were monogamous, so Buddhism championed monogamy. In other cultures, they had polygamy, and so that was fine in Buddhist context. In Tibetan culture, there's polyandry, where they have one woman and a number of husbands. And that's considered to be fine, because in those cultures that was considered to be fine. In ancient India, which is often a kind of reference point, the time of the Buddha, it was understood that in certain kind of culturally agreed situations, sexuality was inappropriate. So you weren't supposed to be involved with someone who was under the guardianship of someone else, either a parent or an elder, which I don't know what that means. But someone like, so a child is under the guardianship of someone. So that child then was off limits. Someone who's married was off limits. However, maybe because it was a patriarchal culture, it was generally understood that men could, who are married, could be involved with other women who weren't under the guardianship and weren't married. So single women who were out in society, a man could be involved in. Likewise, a woman who was an adult and no longer under the guardianship of anybody, and there were such women who were kind of free and independent, they were free to be involved sexually in whatever way they chose. There wasn't any kind of cultural definitions. And there's a wide variety of ways which that happened. Right. If you read the ancient Buddha sutras, you find many examples of both female sexuality and male sexuality. And in the history of Buddhism, Buddhists have often used the life of the Buddha as kind of a paradigm for a spiritual life. And they pointed to the fact that before the Buddha left home, before the Buddha started his spiritual quest, he had a very active sexual life. He was a prince, and he had a wife, but he also had a harem. There was nothing wrong, I suppose, at least from certain people's point of view at that time, for men to have harems. And there was nothing, that was part of the culture, I guess, if you were especially royalty. So he had a wife, and he had a whole harem, and some of the Buddhist literature are quite graphic in discussing what went on in the Buddha's harem. So Buddhists have pointed back to that and said, oh, having a healthy sexual life maybe is a foundation upon later having a spiritual life, or is part of it. It's not, the Buddha did it, so it should be fine for everybody else as a layperson. So Buddhism didn't say much about lay sexuality, and mostly in many Buddhist cultures, what happens behind the bedroom door has been people's private business. And the Buddhist church hasn't paid much attention, hasn't cared very much what happens behind the bedroom door. It's not an issue so much. So sexuality has in some ways a very different feel in Buddhism, in Buddhist culture, than it has, I think, in Christian culture, where there's a certain level of guilt and shame which has come through parts of it at times. And as being part of Indian culture, Buddhists of India, I think, had a fairly positive attitude towards sexuality. However, monastic Buddhism, or the Buddhism associated with real deep spiritual practice, has had somewhat of a negative view towards sexuality. And people have pointed out that Buddhism as a religious practice is more sex negative than sex positive. And religions like Judaism and Hinduism and Islam have a much more of a sex positive attitude towards sexuality, people have pointed out. And part of the reason for that is that a traditional dogma of Buddhism is that if you're really serious about spiritual practice, you can't be involved in sexuality. Or at some point, as your practice deepens and deepens, you'll stop being involved in any sexual activity at all. At some point you naturally become celibate. So I don't know. I mean, there's very few people who follow the path that far who can really say that sexuality has dropped away. Or if it's dropped away, it's kind of complicated. Maybe it's what's actually gone on. So Buddhism doesn't say a lot about integrating this practice with sexuality, but there are a lot of resources that Buddhism has that can help us in approaching this area, I feel. And some of the resources are, I think, loving-kindness and metta and compassion and the kind of divine emotions which are cultivated in Buddhism are a lot to do about how we relate to people, kind of how we form relationships with people. And a guided meditation that I've done now a couple of times with other groups that I've discussed this with is a loving kindness meditation. Whereas usually when you do loving kindness meditation, you're told, told specifically not to do it towards someone who you're sexually attracted to, or potentially. So often you're not even supposed to choose someone of the opposite sex, except generically all women or all men. But if you choose someone you feel very close to, you said, but don't, you know, choose someone who's the same sex as you. And here in the West, we don't do that so much. But however, it's still, that's the tradition. So what I do is I do a guided loving kindness meditation, first for yourself, and then I do it towards someone else you feel close to. And then I do loving kindness back to yourself, and establish yourself in that space again. And then you choose someone who you're a sexual partner to, or someone you feel sexually attracted to. And then you extend your loving kindness specifically to that person. And then you do a kind of imagination exercise where you imagine yourself being involved in a sexual activity with this person, coming out of this place of loving kindness. And this has been very, very useful and very interesting for people. Not that all sexuality has to come out of loving kindness, but it shows people, it gives some people a sense of a very, very different way of having sexual expression. And that seemed like that was an interesting exercise. One person, when I did it at Stanford, one of the students wrote to me, emailed me afterwards, and said that it was liberating to realize that he was in a room full of people, and all the other people in the room were having sexual thoughts. And that it was fine. Not only was it fine, but it was being encouraged. And he felt it really helped him because he came from a very strong religious background where he felt a lot of shame and guilt around his sexuality. And kind of to have it so public and so open was kind of helpful for him. So loving kindness is one resource. Another resource is the emphasis in mindfulness practices on being embodied and just kind of being more fully embodied. And there's a tendency, I think, many people, I think maybe in the West, to separate certainly mind and body, spirit and body. The body is somehow secondary to spirit, which is lofty, and spirit has nothing to do with sexuality because sexuality is of the body, and create a kind of split. And so people aren't very much in their sexual body, but not in their body often at all. And so the emphasis on becoming embodied that we have, and becoming familiar with your body and sensing your body, I think is great to become helping people become more familiar with their sexual life. But also more importantly, I think, I believe that as sexual beings, we're sexual kind of as a whole being. And there's a tendency, I think, for people to put a lot of focus on genital pleasure or sensations. And that's where sexuality, you know, resides, is in the genitals. But I think sexuality is something that resides in the whole body. And it's a little bit neurotic, I think, to have it so specifically focused on the genitals. And so as we become more awake throughout the whole body, I think there's maybe a possibility of maybe more healthy sexuality. There's this koan, Zen koan, which I've read before. The monk Yen asked the monk Wu, "What does the bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes for?" And the bodhisattva of compassion is this kind of deity. And in some of the image of this deity, you see there's like 1,000 hands. And each hand has an eye, so there's 1,000 eyes kind of coming off the body. And usually it's said that she or he has all these hands and eyes. The eyes are so she can see the all the suffering in the world. And the hands are so she can help. So he has 1,000 hands and eyes. So the monk asks, why does she have all these hands and eyes? So the second monk, Wu, said, it is like, and this is like Zen, right? It is like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow in the middle of the night. And kind of what I understand, how I understand that, is that little bit understand it is that when you're kind of half asleep at night and you want to kind of adjust the pillow to make yourself comfortable, there's almost like no intention there. It's just kind of like, almost like a natural act. You're kind of reaching back, and it's like one of the most natural things in the world to reach back and kind of bunch up the pillow. And for this deity, of bodhisattva, of compassion, to have all these eyes and hands and respond to suffering in the world, is as natural as you know, the bunching up the pillow on the back. There's no complicated event. Just as natural as that. It's almost like there's no separation between you and the pillow. You know, it's like no separation between you and the world. So this, the monk Yen said, oh, also said, I understand. You should never say that in Zen. And so Wu said, how do you understand it? And Yen said, all over the body are hands and eyes. And all over your body are hands and eyes. And that's pretty good. I mean, all over your body are these sense organs, hands and eyes. The eyes and hands aren't just, you know, here and the hands, but all over. But Wu said, you've said quite a bit here. It's pretty good. But you've only explained 80% of it. Now, Zen is a tradition that says you shouldn't pick and choose. No picking and choosing in Zen. But they like to have percentages. I had one teacher, one Zen master in Japan, who asked me a question. And he asked me, do you like weather when it's warm or is it cold? Sounds like a very innocent question, right? And I said something, and he said, that was 20%. So you've only explained 80%. And then Yen said, what would you say, elder brother? And Wu said, throughout the body are hands and eyes. So 80% is just all over the body, kind of on the surface maybe. But something more intimate, more complete is throughout the body. And that's kind of what we discover, I think, in the mindfulness practice as we drop down into our body and live in our body, in the lived body. So that's part of one of the resources we have. And throughout the body, one of the things we are careful for in Buddhism is a tendency to objectify things, to treat things as objects. And certainly treating our body as an object, it can lead to great problems. Feeling the body from the inside out is one way not to objectify the body so much. And one of the questions that I often ask is, what do you think about your body? How do you think about your body? Is it the body that you have, or is it the body that you are? Which of those answers would you have? And is it, do you have a body, or are you a body? And I think if you have a body, there can be a tendency to separate yourself from your body. If you are a body, there's more less division. And this thing about so being in your body, I think we have a very different relationship to our sexuality if we come out of our body. Part of the great difficulty, I think, with our sexuality is that it's a very sexuality and our sexual life and sexual activity is very complicated. It's one of the, someone said that sexual relationships is the most complex form of communications human beings have. There's tremendous complexity involved, and people have all these strong opinions about it, as if it's like this one thing, and it's like really complicated. There's all these different component parts that we have to kind of begin to discover, and I think mindfulness practice is learning to kind of separate out some of the complications to see more clearly what's really going on. So some of the complications. What are some of the things that we associate our sexuality with? Maybe not any of us here, but in our culture. Sometimes sexuality is associated with aggression. Sometimes with security. Sometimes with fear. Sometimes with anger. Sometimes with restlessness. How many of you have been involved in sexual activity because you had insomnia? Power, possession, possessiveness. What are some of the other things? Yeah. Death? Yes. Okay.
Love.
Well, thank you. Something else?
Beauty.
Uh-huh. What are some other associations?
Hope.
Yeah. Hope. That's a loaded one. Desire?
Compassion.
Compassion. What?
Passion.
Did I just see you? And what else? Celebration. Yes?
Play.
Getting something from the other person. The difference between using someone and sharing something with someone. And what can we get from another person?
Courage.
Get courage from another person. Support, stability, security.
Communication.
Get communication.
Affirmation.
The illusion of completeness.
The illusion of completeness.
Need.
Need? What kind of need?
A need to be connected.
A need to be connected.
The dissolution of boundaries.
Dissolution of boundaries. A desire for that? Or just...
The actuality, the experience of it.
Uh-huh.
Children.
You must have been born before the pill.
Jealousy.
It's a very complicated event. And there's a lot of things that come into it. And maybe for you it's simple, but in our culture it's very complicated what goes on. So beginning to kind of understand some of these things and separate them out. So that's much of what mindfulness does, just being aware. The other thing that mindfulness, the other thing is that there's a lot of messages from our culture about what sexuality is about. And so we feel like we have to, if we don't fit kind of certain cultural stereotype molds of what sexuality is, then something's wrong. If we don't have passionate sex like you see in the movies, maybe something's wrong, you know. But the movies, you know, that's just the movies. But there are people who are concerned about comparing themselves to what happens on the silver screen. Do I sweat as much as I do? when I spent about 3 years in a monastery, where it was a Tassajara, where there wasn't any vows of celibacy in this monastery, but there wasn't much sexual activity going on. At least I wasn't involved in any of it. And what happened there in this 3 years of intensive practice, I pretty quickly became asexual. And after 3 years of this, I figured, well, I guess I'm an asexual person. Mm-hmm. That's who I am. And I felt pretty comfortable with that. But I could feel that it felt somehow awkward, because it was kind of to be asexual or not to be in sexual activity, not be interested in it. I had this feeling a little bit that's kind of being a sexual deviant in our culture. Mm-hmm. People don't understand it, or they think you're kind of weird, or something's wrong with you or something. And many people, periods of their life, or because of their nature, are basically asexual or are for periods. And our culture, I think, for many of us, doesn't really make it a comfortable place to be, even asexual. So there's a lot of cultural messages we get. And what are some of the cultural messages we've gotten? Let's go around for that for a couple of minutes.
Not supposed to enjoy stuff
for yourself. Not supposed to enjoy it for yourself.
It's not okay to be alone.
It's not okay to be alone, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What are the cultural messages, social messages we've had about our sexuality?
You're an incomplete person.
You're incomplete. And you're complete only by joining with someone.
When you get older, you should forget it.
Older, you should get it. I knew a woman. She was in her 60s. I don't know. She's old. Oh, that's not old. She was in her 60s, and she did her PhD in her 60s, and her topic for her dissertation was vital women in their 80s. And so one of the things she studied was their vital sexuality. And what else?
Stories of sexual
sexual with somebody of a different sex.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I think that the mindfulness practice hopefully does is clear away some of these cultural conditions we have, cultural conditionings, and some of the complicated associations we bring into play, so we can listen to our own inner voice, our own inner sexuality, and find out what that is for ourselves, and come from that place. And that might look very different than what culture tells us, what we've been brought up to tell us, what our families told us. Who knows what it'll look like? It might be very different than what our spouse or our partner wants us even to have certain times. But to recognize that and to kind of find what is true for oneself, I think, is a very what should be coming out of, I think, Buddhist practice. And then to have the courage, once you've discovered it, to live by that way. And one of the ways to do that, I think, especially if you have partners, is to be honest about what's going on, to talk about it. And there's very little talking that goes on, is my impression around sexuality. And even in my own relationship with my wife, we talk about it some, but I think we could talk more about it. And I've tried sometimes, you know, to bring it up, and we talk about it sometimes, but it's very easy to get sidetracked or to kind of not talk about it for a while. Or, you know, talk about it. It's a big area of our life. There's a lot of so not treating something as an object means also not treating someone else as an object, but also not treating sexual goals as objects. And one of the things that's happened in our culture, around a number of kind of more recent culture, especially in California, is idealizing certain areas of our life. And one place you see it, one idealized area is death. There's a lot of literature about the glorious way people die. And they're wonderful, you see light and all these wonderful things happen, people die. And some of that happens, and I think we've been a culture that until recently has often denied death and kind of pushed it away. But some of these books kind of overdo it and idealize it. And people who work in the dying profession have pointed out that it's doing a disservice, because a lot of people don't die beautiful deaths. And to say that all death is beautiful sets up an expectation which is unrealistic and cause pain. Same thing with sexuality. That you know, there's books about, you know, neo-tantra, you know, about the great ecstasy and spiritual unions you can have with sexuality, great ecstatic experiences. And those things are possible. But if we hold them up too much as ideals, that can be a problem for people. That can create a lot of suffering. Just your sexuality is what it is. I think that the mindfulness practice, as I said earlier, is not so much about a goal, about getting somewhere, but it's about being vulnerable and open to a process of honesty and communication. And so if we do that and allow ourselves to become vulnerable and explore our fears, our desires, our passions, our joys and everything, and understand it's a process of opening to that and being vulnerable to it all, then something might happen in the process. Who knows what will happen? It's best to leave it maybe unstated. But if it becomes too much of a, you're supposed to kind of, it's very easy to treat our sexuality as an object. And it's supposed to be a certain way. Let's have a ritual, let's have, you know, this ecstatic ritual, let's have this ecstatic experience. If it doesn't happen, then I'm going to find someone else. Or. And someone pointed out this thing about sexuality can be a celebration. And I think it can be a celebration of sorts. But I think it's very easy people who indulge in their body in various ways, people who indulge in sexuality, it's very easy for that indulgence to be treating sexuality and treating your body and treating the other person as objects, all as objects. There's a kind of separation. And if people are too enthusiastic about sexuality, then I begin wondering, you know, if there's some objectification that's going on, that's separating themselves from it in some way. Can I continue maybe for 5 more minutes? Mm-hmm. It's 9:00. Mm-hmm. I could probably continue more, and I should just... And what I should be doing is giving have a chance for more discussion, because the wisdom is the collective wisdom, because I'm not an expert. But one of the interesting things was when I did this at Stanford, this topic, I asked people the question, what is the relationship between your sexuality and your mindfulness practice, your awareness practice, your spiritual practice, or your religious practice, whichever one of those four words kind of works for you. And I think that's the interesting question for many of us who are involved in one of those pursuits, depending on the word you like for yourself. What is the relationship? Do you see a relationship? So I asked the students, you know, what it was. And then one woman, the first person who spoke up, said for her, the relationship was mindfulness helped clarify the complications and what was going on, so she can be present at more directly, more simply, for what was actually going on in her sexual life. And then one of the guys spoke, and he was somewhat more, this person has a more idealistic streak in him around spirituality, and he said that he was more interested in sacred sexuality, in the sense that sexuality was a gateway to a doorway to union with the universe. You can have this great cosmic union, feeling of kind of dissolving into universe. And that can happen sometimes, great feelings of unity and whatever. But what struck me was the contrast between the two. And in some sense, for the woman, attitude towards mindfulness practice and sexuality was just simply helping her be more fully in the present with what was actually already here. And the fellow, his attitude was what I called more utilitarian, was that sexuality was for a purpose, was to get somewhere, and to get there was towards this great union. And so that's interesting, just that, the difference. And then I pointed out, and I don't know if it was fair to do this or if even appropriate, because I don't really understand exactly what he was talking about, and it could be a misunderstanding. But I said, how would you feel if you were involved in a sexual union with someone, sexual relationship, intimate with someone, and they were communing with the universe? Hey, I'm here. But it could be that they're both people actually talking about the same thing, and that for him, communing with the universe was simply being fully present for his partner. I don't know. So I think in mindfulness practice, we're trying to discover ordinary sexuality. Mindfulness practice is a lot about ordinary life, and in the context of the ordinary, sometimes the extraordinary happens. But we don't usually pursuing the extraordinary in and of itself. We're really trying to clarify the ordinary. It's kind of like this quote that I like from The Course of Miracles, which I've never read. But I came across this quote somewhere else. Your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it. And so who knows what appropriate sexuality is, but let all the barriers, let them all go, all your fears and barriers and shames and guilts, and discover what it is like for the first time. It's wonderful to do that. And what the relationship between your sexuality and your spirituality will be as your spirituality deepens, that is a big unknown. The Buddhist tradition says, Doug, that your sexuality will fall away. But maybe that was the monks who said that. And we as lay people, many of us in the West are dedicated towards the spiritual practice and being lay people at the same time. And in part, maybe we're asking for too much, like we want everything. But I think it's also very beautiful, because it's a spirituality which is not rejecting anything or denying anything. But what it means is it's also an experiment. What will happen as we do this wonderful experiment? And can we do it really honestly and clearly and consciously, including our sexuality? And what will happen if we do that? What will happen to our spiritual life, our sexual life? So I think we need to find forums or ways to talk about it, explore it, discuss it at times. We don't want to put any special weight on it. It should have just as much weight as eating meditation. You know, we talk about eating meditation almost every retreat. but I don't know when we should talk about it, but I think it should be occasionally, you know. And the other reason I think it's important to talk about it, to have it out on the table, is there have been a lot of sexual scandals in the Buddhist world in America in the last 15 years. And one of the reasons, there's many reasons for this, but one of the reasons for this is that sexuality hasn't been put out on the table. We haven't discussed it. We haven't explored it and looked at all the issues and stuff. And when you're not discussing something and something's kind of in the closet or lost or hid, tucked away in the shadows, there's a lot more chance for unhealthy activity to arise out of the shadows. And when something's not being discussed. So if we discuss it all, and I think also the teachers who are involved in sexual misconduct